Hello everyone, welcome to this educational session on acute myeloid leukemia. I'm going to be discussing a new therapeutic era in AML. My name is Amir Fathi. I'm the director of the leukemia program at Massachusetts General Hospital. I'm also associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. This first slide lists my disclosures. So as a way of background, at least as of 2020, AML is luckily a relatively uncommon malignancy. Approximately 20,000 new cases per year in the United States. Unfortunately, we continue to have more than 10,000 deaths a year from AML in the United States, and it continues to be a challenging, often lethal disease. Part of the challenge related to AML is the median age is 67, and every year this median age creeps up a little bit as the population gets older. And what that also means is that half of our patients are predominantly in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, which makes aggressive intensive therapy difficult. Let's briefly talk about prognostication of AML based on molecular data. So AML traditionally, at least according to the European Leukemia Net and other categorizations, is categorized according to adverse, intermediate, or favorable risk disease. Favorable risk disease is related to certain chromosomal or mutational data that render the disease more susceptible to traditional chemotherapy. Unfortunately, there are many more categories of adverse risk AML, including complex karyotype, inversion 3, isolated FLT3 mutations, deletion of 7, deletion of 5. All of these abnormalities render the disease either more resistant to therapy or more likely to relapse. If you do not have a favorable risk feature or an adverse risk signature, there is a large chunk of AML patients who are considered intermediate risk. And based on your risk from this molecular and cytogenetic data, the survival curves can be splayed out. The top two curves, A and B, look at disease-free and overall survival among younger patients. And those at the bottom are those individuals who are 60 years or over. As you can see, patients who are older have a substantially worse prognosis, regardless of the favorable, intermediate, or adverse risk. That's kind of where we've been for some time, but AML has also been substantially more complex, or we found it to be, it's always been more complex, but we've learned much more about it. Here is a pie graph of all the different subtypes of AML and the features they share in terms of molecular features. The targets that we have learned about in recent years have been FLT3 mutated disease. There is actually a small molecule inhibitor, multiple small molecule inhibitors of FLT3. FLT3 is a receptor tyrosine kinase that resides on the surface of the cell, and the mutation of the gene causes the alteration of that receptor, causing rapid uncontrolled proliferation of the myeloid blast. IDH mutations are also another target of therapy with the small molecule inhibitors of IDH1 and IDH2. IDH alterations lead to the uncontrolled production of an oncometabolite called 2-HG that leads to the myeloid malignancy phenotype. The more common alterations in AML are FLT3, NPM1, and DNMT3A, but there is a long list of alterations that are seen in patients with favorable risk, intermediate risk, and adverse risk disease, as can be seen in the bar graph here. More recently, we've been able to look not just at categorizations according to disease risk, but also specifically look at mutations and chromosomal changes individually. And alterations such as inversion 3 and mutations such as P53, as can be shown in this curves, if harbored in a patient's MDS or AML, are risks that are very adverse and lead to a shortened lifespan and really poor survival. Regardless of the risk, if a patient has relapsed AML or AML that is refractory, their outcomes are dismal. This is a curve that I borrowed from a paper for about 10 years ago. I don't think much has changed since then. Perhaps it's a little bit better. But 5-year survival in patients younger than 55 or over 55 remains quite poor. But there is some reason for hope. For decades, the therapeutic landscape of AML had not changed. Since the late 1960s, there were two or three chemotherapies that were used as upfront and relapse regimens for patients with AML. However, I was lucky enough when I joined the faculty at Mass General in approximately 2010. Soon thereafter, there were multiple drugs that entered clinical trials, and many of which ended up being highly promising, leading to FDA approvals, including IDH inhibitors, FLT3 inhibitors, antibody drug conjugates, liposomal products, and ultimately we've had, I believe, 9 approvals in the last few years in AML. So it's a very exciting time to be a part of this field. Let's talk about IDH mutated disease first. So the first description of IDH mutations occurred approximately 10, 12 years ago. IDH1 mutations were discovered in 8% of patients with AML in a cohort of patients that were evaluated and were associated with a normal cytogenetic status. So patients with normal chromosomal cytogenetics are enriched for IDH mutations. A subsequent study found a larger subset, 15%, had IDH2 mutations. So what are IDH proteins? You know, we've all learned the Krebs cycle in high school, college, perhaps graduate school. IDH stands for isocitrate dehydrogenase. It's a key enzyme that converts isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, leading to the production of ATP and energy for the cell in the case of IDH1 and mitochondria in the case of IDH2. When there is an alteration, as can be shown in the figure here, in the genes of IDH1 and IDH2, leading to the development of IDH1 and IDH2 mutations, there is actually the altered IDH proteins lead to a catalysis of an alternative reaction, the conversion of alpha-ketoglutarate to 2-hydroxyglutarate, 2-HG. As a result, 2-HG, a normally suppressed metabolite, is built up in the cells, mitoplasm, mitochondria, as well as body fluids of patients who have IDH mutated AML. And 2-HG is an oncometabolite, which is normally low in patients who do not have AML. But in AML with an IDH mutation, 2-HG builds up, suppresses key enzymes such as TET2, leads to aberrant hypermethylation of key promoter regions that are important for differentiation and maturation of myeloid cells. This hypermethylation suppresses normal maturation, and as a result, an emergence of myeloid malignancy is seen. Not only do we learn about the biology of IDH mutations and how they can lead to the myeloid malignancy phenotype, such as in MDS and AML, but they also lead to drug development. So soon after the discovery of IDH mutations in malignancy, drug companies have started to develop small molecules that inhibit the aberrant IDH2 and IDH1 proteins. The first drug that emerged was enasidenib, effectively and specifically inhibited mutant IDH2 and was then studied in phase 1 and phase 2 and expansion studies. And similarly, ivosidenib was a specific and highly potent IDH1 mutated inhibitor of the IDH1 altered protein and was studied in IDH1 mutated relapse or refractory AML. Let's briefly talk about IDH2 mutated AML and enasidenib in that patient cohort. As mentioned, the first studies of enasidenib were in dose expansion, dose escalation, dose expansion, and phase 2 studies of enasidenib. Ultimately, a dose of 100 milligrams daily was settled on and was studied in multiple cohorts. One of those cohorts and a larger relapse refractory phase 2 cohort assessed the promise of enasidenib and found an overall response rate approximating 40% and a composite remission rate in these relapse refractory patients of 30%. Now, these are the rates you see with traditional intensive therapy for relapse refractory treatment that come with high morbidity, but enasidenib was highly well tolerated. Not only did it lead to these high response rates, patients also had other improvements, such as improvements in transfusions, quality of life, longevity. So median overall survival was also quite long. And these overall response rates composite remission rates, as can be shown in the lower table, were preserved in patients who had refractory disease to either higher intensity treatment or lower intensity therapy. This is the median overall survival of patients receiving this IDH2 inhibitor. The median overall survival was 9 months, but in individuals who had CRs, it approximated 20 months. And even in those who did not achieve CR or complete remission, but had lesser responses, such as improvement in blood counts, decrease in marrow blasts that didn't quite meet the bar of CR, the median overall survival remained quite impressive at approximating 14 months. Ivosidenib, the IDH1 inhibitor, selective and potent inhibitor of the IDH1 protein. Similarly, you have this improvement in overall survival in patients who responded and a similar rate of response. The key thing to think about with both enasidenib and ivosidenib is that not only did patients achieve response, but a substantial proportion of them, even in those who did not achieve marrow remissions, had improvements in transfusions, as can be shown in the bar graph, with decreased red cell and platelet transfusion dependence. Enasidenib and ivosidenib, IDH inhibitors, can be combined also with induction chemotherapy and studied. And in fact, clinical studies of the combination of 7 and 3 with either of these IDH inhibitors were launched, and we were a part of these studies and led to very promising rates of composite remission. Now, we can't really say more than that because this was not a comparator study versus induction chemotherapy by itself, but additional data is needed to really assess the promise of the combination of IDH inhibitors with induction chemotherapy. IDH inhibitors have also been combined with other conventional drugs for AML, including hypomethylating agents, which for years have been used as therapy for older patients or those who are not eligible for intensive therapies. This demonstrates the multiple studies that were done with ivosidenib plus AZA, as well as enasidenib with AZA, azacitidine rather, a key hypomethylating drug. This is the randomized phase two portion of enasidenib plus azacitidine versus azacitidine alone. As can be seen, the overall response rate and the composite remission rate of enasidenib and azacitidine was markedly higher than with azacitidine alone, allowing this phase two study to meet its primary endpoint and to be deemed successful. However, the overall survival, which was a secondary endpoint, did not meet statistical significance in terms of superiority. Many reasons could be brought up for it. Multiple patients in the enasidenib, in the azacitidine alone arm subsequently went on to receive enasidenib. There was some fallout in the azacitidine arm, so it's hard to really know the specific reason why the higher composite remission rate did not translate into an improvement in overall survival, although there was some indication of improvement in event-free survival, as can be seen there, again, not reaching statistical significance. One key point to bring up is that IDH inhibitors are quite well tolerated. Ivosidenib is associated with QT prolongation, and enasidenib is associated with a benign elevation in bilirubin. Otherwise, these drugs are well tolerated. They can cause some cytopenias, but they're quite mild. However, both drugs can be associated with a condition called differentiation syndrome. And that is a feature of the underlying mechanism of action of these IDH inhibitors. IDH inhibitors, as I mentioned, are differentiating drugs, meaning they inhibit 2-HG, suppress TET, lead to a release of the block on differentiation that is seen in AML, and therefore these AML cells begin to differentiate and normalize and normally mature. Well, that process of maturation and differentiation can be associated with a cytokine-mediated inflammatory process that can manifest itself in a pleomorphic diverse manner, such as patients coming in with unexplained fevers or pulmonary infiltrates or pleural effusions or rash or mild renal failure. These symptoms can mimic other common things that you see with AML, secondary causes such as leukemic progression itself or an infection or a cardiopulmonary manifestation. Nevertheless, because differentiation syndrome can be quite aggressive and lethal if not recognized, we recommend very close monitoring for it and treatment if it is suspected. even if a patient comes in and one suspects an infection as the cause but cannot truly rule out differentiation syndrome, I think it is entirely appropriate to treat the infection but also treat for potential differentiation syndrome if the symptoms and the timing make sense. And generally, differentiation syndrome arises anywhere between 2 weeks and 6 months after exposure to IDH inhibitor therapy if it does occur. And typically, the severest forms of differentiation syndrome impact anywhere between 13 to 20% of patients who are treated with differentiation syndrome, so it's not a small number. But the real therapy is dexamethasone, typically given at 10 milligrams twice daily. Stopping the drug by itself won't do the trick because of the long half-life of these agents. Sometimes you have to stop the drug, but the first option is always steroid. Now, differentiation syndrome can co-occur with hyperleukocytosis as the cells differentiate, in which case hydrea may be necessary. It can also co-occur with disseminated intravascular coagulation and tumor lysis syndrome, and both of those conditions also need to be managed as well if they occur. Let's move on to FLT3 inhibitors and FLT3 mutations. So FLT3 mutations come in two major flavors. The more common type of a FLT3 mutation is the ITD mutation. The less common variant are the multiple different tyrosine kinase domain or the TKD mutations impacting the FLT3 receptor tyrosine kinase, which is a receptor tyrosine kinase like many other receptor tyrosine kinases like EGFR, VEGF, and KIT. And the FLT3 receptor resides on myeloid precursors in the marrow, and when there is a mutation, this FLT3 receptor unfortunately becomes less and less ligand dependent and becomes more active. And as a result, the cells, the myeloid cells, begin to proliferate in out of control fashion, leading to a proliferative form of AML that oftentimes relapses and is difficult to control even after transplant. Over the course of the last 10 to 15 to 20 years, folks have attempted to learn more about FLT3 and develop small molecule inhibitors of FLT3. And the initial series of first generation of FLT3 inhibitors were actually developed for other receptor tyrosine kinases and therefore were quite nonspecific and promiscuous, drugs like lasertib and midostaurin. More recently, agents such as quizartinib and gilteritinib are more potent and more sensitive for FLT3 and are currently being studied in clinical trials. Midostaurin, as I mentioned, one of the first generation of FLT3 inhibitors, relatively nonspecific, was studied as single agent in clinical trial, but also combined with chemotherapy. As a single agent, not particularly active. But with chemotherapy, it showed promise, and a subsequent phase 3 study compared the combination of the FLT3 inhibitor midostaurin with chemotherapy versus chemotherapy and placebo, and found the midostaurin arm to be superior to the placebo-containing arm with a substantially longer median overall survival. It was a 23% reduction in risk of death, and at 4 years, 51% were alive in the midostaurin arm as opposed to 44% in placebo, in the placebo arm. Gilteritinib, one of the newer generation of FLT3 inhibitors, much more potent and selective, has been studied in AML as well, but in the relapse refractory setting as monotherapy. And in this phase 3 study was compared to multiple different salvage chemotherapy options that were deemed to be standard at the time and showed to be again markedly superior with an improvement in median overall survival, leading to the approval of both midostaurin for frontline setting in combination with induction chemotherapy and gilteritinib as monotherapy for relapse refractory AML. Let's move on to other potential points of utility for FLT3 inhibitors in AML. At our institution, we've looked at FLT3 inhibitors as therapy following bone marrow transplant. As I mentioned, AML with a FLT3 mutation is a highly proliferative, aggressive disease marked by multiple relapses, typically and historically. Well, we thought that these patients who get transplanted with FLT3 mutations and may have a reduction in risk if they received FLT3 inhibitor oral therapy as maintenance following the transplant. And in fact, we found looking at this at a FLT3 inhibitor called sorafenib given after a transplant led to a marked reduction in the risk of relapse in patients who received the FLT3 inhibitor. Subsequent studies have looked at post-transplant sorafenib maintenance in randomized fashion. So the SORMAIN trial run in Europe looked at compared sorafenib versus control following transplant and found that in patients who received sorafenib, there was a marked improvement in two-year relapse-free survival, as well as overall survival. There was no substantial increase in graft versus host disease or GI toxicity. There was another phase three study by Schwann and colleagues published in Lancet Oncology. That too revealed a markedly decreased relapse rate in patients who received sorafenib after bone marrow transplant. So I would say that most academic institutions now incorporate FLT3 inhibitor therapy following transplantation. Around the same time, a large phase three study looked at the more potent and selective FLT3 inhibitor gilteritinib following transplant, a randomized study versus placebo. And that study has now finished accrual, and we're looking very much forward to results. Quizartinib, another FLT3 inhibitor, was studied in the Quantum First phase three trial that incorporated a year of maintenance following induction and consolidation. We've talked about IDH mutations in AML, let's talk about, and FLT3 mutations, let's talk about P53. P53 is among the ugliest mutations in human cancer. It's no exception in AML, P53. The presence of a P53 mutation is associated with poor outcomes in both MDS, a pre-leukemic condition, as well as AML. However, there is some suggestion of therapeutic activity and with certain agents. Let's start with the hypomethylating therapy such as azacitidine and decitabine. A study published by Welch and colleagues from Washington University and published in 2016 in the New England Journal found that patients who had P53 mutations seemed to respond to hypomethylating therapy quite well, with a reduction in the allelic fraction of P53 mutations in treated patients. So up until very recently, the approach to patients with P53 mutated MDS and AML was treatment with a hypomethylating agent, such as decitabine or azacitidine. I have to say that subsequent studies that have looked at P53 mutations and hypomethylating agents have not seen as quite an impressive response as was seen in this New England Journal article. Nevertheless, it's something to consider. APR246, a P53 activating molecule, also has shown substantial promise in single arm studies and has been studied in both MDS and AML. Here is a swimmer plot showing that multiple patients that received the combination of azacitidine and APR246 had prolonged responses and long-term overall survival. Data is ongoing in both MDS and AML in randomized studies. We shall see what these results demonstrate, but a promising drug. Another agent is magrolimab, a CD47 antibody that basically interferes with the do not eat me signal that is overexpressed in myeloid malignancies, leading to macrophage phagocytosis of leukemic cells who no longer express that signal. By itself, magrolimab does not have substantial activity in MDS and AML, but when combined with azacitidine, there is a substantial increase in composite remission rate of approximately 60 to 70%. And not only do we see this in AML in total, in a smaller subset of patients with P53 mutations, there is also a high rate of response, which is quite intriguing, including a substantial reduction in blasts and an improvement in median overall survival. Again, the number of P53 mutated patients studied in these cohorts of AML are small, so we need a larger data set, hopefully to be presented at meetings and years ahead and published to tell us more about whether this combination of magrolimab and azacitidine has activity that is robust in P53 mutated disease. So therefore, overall, I would say there are reasons for optimism. We have improved outcomes due to better prognostication, patient selection, and supportive care. We have emergence of effective and targeted therapies, such as IDH inhibitors, such as FLT3 inhibitors, such as antibody drug conjugates, but also perhaps newer and emerging drugs for the most resistant diseases we treat, such as those with P53 mutations. There are novel combinations that are available for older patients that we didn't talk about today, but the combination of azacitidine and venetoclax was approved for patients who are older or are not eligible for intensive therapies. There are also newer combinations that we've talked about, such as the combination of azacitidine with APR246 or with magrolimab. And ultimately, the most intriguing question is whether the upcoming decade will see even more approved therapies than the last four decades combined. I very much appreciate your attention. Thank you so much.